What does the history of Nazi Germany have to tell us about today?
Even if you choose to imagine that history doesn't matter at all, there are always people out there who are nostalgic for the darker periods of history, and they might well be in power. In fact, at the moment, they are.
That's historian Timothy Snyder. We talk with him about possibly the most important book for us to read right now, On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Then, has the shift to dictatorship already happened?
At this moment in time, there is no legal accountability whatsoever for what the president does, as long as he invokes national security.
That's Ryan Alford. We talk with him about his chilling study of how national security claims have undermined the rule of law in America. It's called Permanent State of Emergency. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Donald Trump's ex-wife, Ivana Trump, once said that he kept a book of Hitler's speeches by his bedside. He already uses the Nazi trope, fake news, Hitler called it the lying press, and has created an office to track crimes committed by immigrants, like the one Hitler created to track crimes committed by Jews. His top aide, Steve Bannon, is a genuine fascist who has made no secret of his admiration for Nazi ideologues. Those are just a few of the worrying signs of the slide toward authoritarianism in the U.S. Timothy Snyder's succinct and pithy book, On Tyranny, tells us what we must know about resisting that slide. The book is a kind of vaccine to inoculate us against acquiescing to authoritarianism. Snyder uses his deep knowledge of European dictatorships like Nazi Germany and Stalin's Russia to extract 20 vital lessons from history, lessons like do not obey in advance, listen for dangerous words, and be as courageous as you can. Snyder says that the threat posed by President Donald Trump means we have at most a year to defend the Republic. Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale University and a Committee on Conscience member at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. He's the author of several previous books, including Bloodlands and Black Earth. Well, Timothy Snyder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Very glad to be with you.
Your book On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, begins with the idea that history does not repeat, but it does instruct. Talk about the difference between those two things.
So I start with the notion of repetition because I'm trying to open up American minds to how history might be useful. When we compare the U.S. to darker periods of European history, or when we even invoke European history to talk about the U.S., the reflexive American response is to say, is it exactly like that? And of course, it's never exactly like that. The United States in 2017 is obviously not exactly like, for example, Germany in 1933. But that, as I see it, is a kind of laziness on our part. We've ceased to think historically about most things, and we kind of flatter ourselves by saying, well, I've just tested to see whether it's exactly the same. It's not exactly the same, therefore we can move on. That's the way the American mind processes, or rather doesn't process, history. What I'm trying to say is that history instructs. That is, if you know a whole lot of different examples, you can find patterns that will be present today, or you can recognize a historical moment in which some elements are similar, or you can identify with someone who experienced something which is a bit like your own predicament, perhaps more intense, and who left behind a useful record of what he or she went through and what he or she can now recommend. So I'm trying to say that history instructs in the sense that if we go back and broaden our imaginations, we'll be able to understand our own moment better and to act in it better. Now, there's also a darker version of history instructs, which is that it's quite clear that some people who are in power today in the United States and elsewhere in the world are instructed by the history of the 1930s in a way that I would like to for us not to be instructed, right? So even if you choose to imagine that history doesn't matter at all, there are always people out there who are nostalgic for the darker periods of history, and they might well be in power. In fact, at the moment, they are.
Now, you look back at the 20th century tyrannies of Hitler and Stalin, but first, you actually start your book out by showing how our founding fathers, back in the 18th century, were inspired by a keen sense of history themselves in writing the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, I'm trying to work within an American tradition, what I think is a powerful American tradition, which is to be skeptical about human nature, to be skeptical about ourselves, and then to look to the past for ways that institutions have not worked out. So the founding fathers were not American exceptionalists. How could they be? There wasn't an America yet. What they were enlightened, sober thinkers who tried to imagine which institutions could check and direct our behavior in such a way as to avoid or to make less likely tyranny. They use the word tyranny a lot, which it's an old Greek word, and that's no accident. They were looking to the past that they knew, which is ancient Greece and then ancient Rome, and trying to understand how ancient Greece, admired as it was by people such as themselves, fell into oligarchy and tyranny. Ancient Rome, admired though it was by people such as themselves, fell into empire, and to try to prevent something like that. I'm trying to respect that American tradition of skepticism and of historical reference and apply it to the history that the founding fathers didn't have. We now have 200 more years of experience with attempts to found democracies and republics. Most of those attempts have actually failed. At the moment when our own democratic republic is threatened, what I'm trying to do is to reach back to the 20th century and to try to learn under what conditions democracies fail so that we can prevent those conditions from arising in our own life.
Timothy Snyder, you've mentioned the idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that our country is somehow unique and different from all others. What's the problem with that idea?
The problem with exceptionalism is that it's like wearing a pair of blinders. You know, everybody's unique, right? I mean, every country is unique. The only thing, you know, the thing about exceptionalism is that it's universal. Everything is exceptional. And once you recognize that, then you can be a little bit calmer about your own nation. The problem with exceptionalism in moments like this is that putting those blinders on can mean that you don't see things that are coming at you from the sides or from the back, threats or history coming back. If you say that, for example, American democracy is going to be American democracy because it's always been American democracy, then you're denying yourself of the sense of urgency that you need. If you say that it can't happen here, you're making it happen here. We're at a moment where one's actions, the actions of American citizens, are more important than they would ordinarily be. Gestures, words, everyday decisions that might not have mattered 3 years ago and hopefully won't matter so much 3 years from now matter an awful lot. So if you say it can't happen here, you're choosing not to do anything. You're making it more likely that it will happen here. If you say American institutions are so wonderful, they will save us automatically, you're undermining those very institutions, because the whole point is those institutions are under attack. And therefore, they need help from American citizens. So exceptionalism is a bit of a trap. I mean, it's important to be proud of one's country. Be a patriot is lesson 19 in the book. But if you want one's country to be its best, especially at moments like this, you have to act on your own.
Another kind of exception you talk about in the book is that laid out by the Nazi legal theorist Carl Schmitt. What does Schmitt's example teach us?
His big idea was that politics starts from enemies and friends. So that's the only meaningful political distinction. And that political sovereignty means that you can declare a state of exception. So he has a book called Political Theology, and the first sentence of that book is, the sovereign is the one who can declare a state of exception. So this is important as a kind of politics, because what he's saying is all the laws, all the rules, all the customs, all the traditions, all the practices, those aren't real. All that's real at the end of the day is the power to discard all of that, the power to say, from now on, we're in a different world where there are going to be new rules. And of course, the thing that Schmitt is going to have in mind after 1933 is the moment when Hitler was able to have a state of exception declared. Hitler comes to power in February 1933, but he's still the chancellor of a republic. Then there's a terrorist attack, and Hitler declares a state of emergency, a state of exception, or he has it declared. The president formally declares it. And after that, you basically have a Nazi regime. So the notion that, something happens and therefore you can cast all the rules aside, that's part of the template of building a modern tyrannical regime. It's a good example of, going back to your first question, of how history instructs. We can choose not to worry about states of exception, but every aspiring tyrant in the world, including Steve Bannon, including Donald Trump, know this template. They know that if there's something like a terrorist attack, they can use that as an excuse to declare a state of exception.
Yes, and in fact, we've already seen that in the United States with the, in some ways, destruction of habeas corpus and the rule of law after 9/11.
So, and I mean, now's a good time to think about 9/11, because 9/11 is a good example of how Americans failed on a couple of important fronts that are very relevant now. We failed to be serious truth seekers about the relationship, or rather the non-relationship, between Iraq, the country that we invaded, and the terrorist attacks of 2001. We, meaning the broader public, we, meaning a great deal of the press, we, meaning the political class, the parts that were in power and some of the parts that weren't. That's not a mistake we can afford to make again. We're now being confronted with a full-on assault on the idea of truth as such, led by the White House, which has become a kind of mendacity industrial complex. If we're not serious about the everyday truth, if we don't support the good investigative journalists working at the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Guardian or other places, we're going to be sunk. The other test of 9/11 is, as you say, the test of the state of exception. We failed then too. We didn't take seriously enough our own freedoms. We got a bit lucky, I'd put it this way, in that our very bad leadership at the time was not as bad as the leadership we have today. So if you look back at our reactions to 9/11, we have to realize if there's something like that again, God forbid, or any kind of horrible, shocking event on the territory of the U.S., it's quite likely that the current leadership will reach for more than the Bush-Cheney team did in 2001, that they will reach for something like a state of exception, that they will ask us to turn over our rights. And so it's very exceptional that we recognize that this is not only a possibility that it could happen, but that this is a whole pattern of politics. In the whole 20th century, we've had terrorism for the whole 20th century. It was actually the age of terror. The first age of terror was the early 20th century. We've had terrorism for the whole 20th century, and modern authoritarians, usually right-wing, but not always. Stalin did this as well. Modern authoritarians seize on moments of fear of terrorism in order to create authoritarian regimes. That is a pattern of politics. We have to see it as a pattern and then recognize if there's a terrorist attack, our emotions are part of a pattern and we have to break it. We can't let our fear and grief prevent us from defending our own rights if there's a terrorist attack here.
Yes, and another thing that tyrants use, as you point out in the book, Timothy Snyder, and On Tyranny, is that they use our very institutions in order to come to power themselves, and that we put a trust in those institutions that may be a little bit out of bounds from what they really deserve. So what do we need to do to make sure that our institutions are in fact robust?
The most basic institution which we rely upon is the institution of the regular election. And it's important to notice that in some of the cases of tyranny that we try to remember, like, for example, Hitler's rise to power, there was an election in the story. The National Socialist Party won the November 1932 elections in Germany, which was one of the reasons why Hitler could come to power. Not the only reason, but it's in the mix. And if we look at the authoritarian regimes around the world today, the majority of them also have an election somewhere in the story. So the way that modern tyrants consolidate regimes has to do with coming to power through elections and then dismantling the system around the elections. Often the elections themselves continue, as they did, in fact, under Nazi Germany, but they are increasingly ritualized and meaningless. So the mistake is to think just because we had an election, the person who won the election cares about a democratic system. It happens over and over again that people like Mr. Trump, who have in fact declared their opposition to the rule of law and their indifference to democratic norms, are elected. And then those people tend to bump up against the walls of the system and to try to change it, which is also true of Mr. Trump. Now, what this means more broadly is that this thing that we call democracy is not just a matter of waiting for every 2 years, every 4 years for there to be an election and then maybe taking part in it. It means that this thing that we call democracy is part of a larger system, a larger constitutional system, a larger rule of law system, which depends not only on the written rules, but also on how we choose to comport ourselves in the meantime. So in lesson two of the book, which is Defend Institutions, I have in mind the constitutional institutions, the judiciary, the legislature. I also have in mind major national institutions like trade unions, for example, labor unions, newspapers. But it's also very important to realize that our professional institutions, whether we're journalists or lawyers or civil servants or doctors, are very important. Regimes can only change when people forget about professional ethics. So now is a time for people to take professional ethics particularly seriously. Likewise, non-governmental organizations, whether they're directly political or not, form a kind of layer between the government and the individual, preventing that situation where the government faces off against the lone individual, which is romantic, but the lonely individual is always going to lose. Freedom is not just freedom of association. Freedom happens because of association. If we spend time with people who have similar political or non-political interests, if we do things with them, we affirm ourselves, we affirm them, and we create a layer of politics between the rulers and ourselves. So institutions in all of those senses are very important.
I kept on thinking as I was reading your book that haven't we seen a slow motion attack on government institutions and democracy through the last several decades? I mean, we can talk about Citizens United and the capture of the state by corporate interests. We can talk about voter suppression efforts by the Republicans that have been extremely successful. We can talk about the hacking of electronic voting machines, no matter who does them, whether it comes from domestic or international agents. You know, we find ourselves at a time when our own democratic institutions have already been eroded. Can we regain the ground and how?
Yeah, and that's a wonderful question. So to start off, I want to say something which is going to sound a little simple and naive, which is that I think democracy is a good idea. I'm not cynical about democracy. I think democratic elections produce better outcomes than non-democratic elections or non-democratic systems, not only in terms of freedom, but also in terms of prosperity. I think that were the American system more democratic, we would also get better outcomes. You mentioned Citizens United, which, you know, ensconces the completely ridiculous principle that money should, you know, essentially count for more votes. As everyone knows, it does. You mentioned voter suppression, which is a problem. The Electoral College is also an undemocratic institution because it means that a voter in one state can have a vote that counts for dozens of times as much as a voter in another state. Gerrymandering, no matter who does it, is also undemocratic. If you're in Ohio, for example, today, and you're a Democrat, your vote counts for roughly half as much as vote a Republican. So for all these reasons, all of those examples, the money, the Electoral College, the gerrymandering, the voter suppression, move us away from a one-person, one-vote system. So democracy in America would be a good thing. It's an aspiration. It's something that we have to get to. Now, a second point that you make that I want to expand on is the attack on government. We can disagree about how much government we need, but we do actually need a government. We do actually have to have politics. And one thing which the American right has fallen into is the habit of saying that whatever goes wrong, it's the fault of the government, even if it's the fault of international capitalism, even if it's the fault of the weather, whatever it might be, it turns out that it's fundamentally the government's fault. That's not what government is. Government is there precisely because economics is unpredictable, or for that matter, because the weather is unpredictable, the world is unpredictable, and government is that set of rules and that set of protections which allow us to live side by side and hopefully be free and prosper all the same. So it makes no sense. We can disagree about exactly what government should do, but attacking government and getting into the mental habit of blaming government for everything is ultimately toxic for us and will drive us down. Now, when it comes to the foreign intervention, I mean, this is something which is being investigated, but it is, I think, rather important if you're a citizen of the United States and you believe not just in democracy, but just in the sovereignty of your country, to take this issue very seriously indeed. For me, this book is a kind of homecoming. What I really do is I really work on Eastern Europe. I work on the darker chapters of European history. I know Russian, I know Ukrainian, I know Polish. Until the last few months, I spent much more time in those languages, German too, French, than I did in English. Bush. And the notion that Russia would try to intervene and undo democracy is completely familiar to me, because that's been underway for the last 5 years. This goes back to exceptionalism. We only notice it when it happens to us, and we think, oh, how is that possible? Maybe that's some kind of crazy conspiracy. Maybe it's just the left-wing media. No, that has been Russia's consistent and very sober and very effective foreign policy for the last half decade. So let's just get used to the fact that it happens in the world, and it very likely happened to us. And I mean, for me, it's not just a question of democracy working. It's a question of the basic honor of the republic. Is it okay if foreign powers decide who rules us? I think it's not. But ultimately, my answer to your question is that I agree. We have to get much better. And the 20 lessons that I try to lay out in the book are meant to be things that not only will help us get through the moment of crisis we're in, but will also train us to become better citizens. Because, of course, you know, the solution is not to go back to 2016. The solution is to have a much healthier civil society. That's ultimately what the book is about.
Yes, and I want to get onto that. But I also want to note that it's probably a good idea, if we want to stand to the high moral ground, that we also should not interfere in other people's elections, which I think has been also part of U.S. foreign policy. However, the first rule is do not obey in advance. And you refer to the policy of Gleichschaltung in Germany. So tell us about the rule and explain what happened in Germany.
So, yeah, rule number one, do not obey in advance, is the most important of all. It's the most important of all because it arises from one of the things that we historians think we understand about 1933 and Nazi Germany, and which political scientists and other scholars believe they understand about other authoritarian regime changes. Namely, at the beginning, the people who aspire to do away with republics and create authoritarian regimes need the consent of the people. They don't need it necessarily in outward forms such as marches or even voting, but they need consent in the sense of people looking away, people drifting along with the new ideas, people not objecting, people looking away as institutions begin to be attacked or as minorities begin to be attacked. That's a very special form of consent. Now, the thing that we also know from sociology and psychology is that that behavior, the obeying advance, is normal. And in most situations, it's appropriate. So we're conducting a phone interview. We both know you're going to ask questions. I'm going to answer questions. That's completely normal. It's normal that when you walk into a new room or into a party or into a meeting, you adjust to the basic rules of the situation. Being a citizen, though, means recognizing that you're in a special moment where that kind of adjustment, that kind of implicit or subconscious self-adjustment to the new situation is actually helping a new regime with new ideas to come to power. So being a citizen means recognizing that, and knowing the history that this is how republics die can help us to recognize that. So it's also number one for another reason, which is that if you can't get number one, that don't obey in advance, then lessons 2 through 20 become irrelevant. If you do obey in advance, if you say, oh, this is normal, it's not a big deal, this is not a major change, I'm going to wait till my friends do something, I'm going to wait till the newspapers are sure. If you do that, then you change yourself psychologically. Once you've taken the first step to say, this is normal, it's extremely hard, in fact, virtually impossible to undo that first step. And then politically, the timing is incredibly important. If you miss the opportunity to not obey in advance, then you use the first weeks and months to tell yourself it's normal. And by then, even if you do persuade yourself that you should do something, it's much harder to act. The first few weeks and months, the first year basically, where we are now, is crucial. If you decide, I'm just going to wait and see, if you decide, this is normal, then what you end up doing is changing yourself internally in a way that you probably never would have expected, because you become a much less free person. And you also blow the chance of making a difference at a crucial historical moment. So that's don't obey in advance.
Yes, and then there's another one, which I think follows on what you just said, and that is be wary of paramilitaries, because we know that there was resistance, maybe not enough, but there was resistance to the Nazis. In Holland, there was the February general strike that was against the Nazi occupation, but it got fiercely put down. So I wonder if you could talk about this, and how do we harden ourselves against the terror from the right?
Yeah, so let me start a slightly different way, which is why paramilitaries are risky in general. I'll come back to left and right, but there's a basic principle here, which is that if you're in a rule of law state, there have to be organs of government whose job it is to enforce the law. They're not going to be perfect. You know, they can be subject to abuse and so on and so forth. But the government has a monopoly on legal force. That's something that we take for granted. You know, if vigilantes appeared on your street, you would think that it's unusual. I mean, I guess depending on where you live in America, but in general, you would think that would be unusual. The way that paramilitaries operate, therefore, is at a very fundamental level. If people get used to the idea that the state doesn't monopolize violence, that there are other institutions out there that also have the right to use violence, then the government is no longer the government. The government blurs, the government wavers, the government becomes the kind of thing that we're not accustomed to. That's one of the elements of Hitler's rise to power. It's also, for that matter, one of the elements of the Bolshevik Revolution and other authoritarian regime changes. You have a paramilitary. You keep it out on the streets. Use it to resist the government. Use it to beat up your enemies. Use it to intimidate the population. And then, and this is the German case, once you have an election, you keep those guys going, and they continue to change the political atmosphere. And then you use them for special tasks, which are maybe illegal. But then what was once illegal starts to become normal over time. In Germany, the classic example is the concentration camp. So that's why, in general, one has to be concerned about paramilitaries. In the U.S. now, where the vast majority of paramilitary activity is on the right, I mean, on various kinds of right, the same principle holds. If one is, for example, in Portland, Oregon, one should be very concerned about the possibility of paramilitaries taking part or supplanting the police in preserving, quote-unquote, order in public demonstrations. If one is a citizen of the United States, one should be very concerned that at Mr. Trump's rallies, he used his private security detail very much the same way that fascists did in the 1920s and 1930s, and then that Mr. Trump expressed the desire to keep his private security detail going when he was president of the United States. That's a basic clash with how the rule of law is supposed to work. If one considers the recent firing of FBI Director James Comey, notice how it was carried out. Mr. Trump sent the head of his private security detail, Mr. Schiller, to go personally fire Mr. Comey. So these are all symptoms of people, either from the paramilitary side or from the executive branch of the United States government, trying to permeate, trying to break through, trying to weaken this basic line, which says if there has to be a threat of violence, it has to be legal. Paramilitaries are a threat to that basic idea, and so they're one fundamental threat to the kind of state that we take for granted.
What about the issue of military contractors and private prisons? Because it seems to me that we already kind of have a mercenary army in place. And in fact, Eric Prince, I think, is a pretty close confidant of the president. And he was, of course, the head of Blackwater, which then morphed into other names. So if you privatize the army and the police and the prisons, what happens to democracy?
Yeah. On Tyranny is a very short book, and I only refer to a few aspects of contemporary American reality, but I do refer to those examples in the little section about paramilitaries. Just for the reason that you give, it's not proper for us to privatize the military. It breaks up the chain of command. It's unfair to the men and women in uniform who find themselves paid less very often than private contractors doing the same thing. It creates uncertainty in the relationship between our votes as citizens and the actions of the people who represent the United States government abroad. It also creates a class of people who have an uncertain relationship to the government. The same can be said about the private prisons, to which there are other objections. So it used to be that, you know, everyone would agree that the police and the army should be part of the government, and then we might disagree about other things. We've now reached the point where a good deal of police and military functions have been privatized. I can only agree with you that I think this is a very bad thing, and it ought to be rolled back. If the government's going to use violence or threaten violence or accumulate the means of violence, it has to be as the government and not as something else. And then the other thing that you hint at, and I quite agree, is that once you have private prisons or private military forces, those things then become meaningful lobbies on their own, right? So if you mention Eric Prince, what does it mean that when the president is seeking secret channels of communication with a foreign power, namely Russia, it's Eric Prince who is sent out to a mysterious island in the Indian Ocean to try to make contact. What it means is that these private military forces, or the people who represent them, are in the center of government decision-making, taking covert actions which have no relationship to anything that the public is ever meant to find out about. And that's obviously a problem.
We talked in the beginning about the politics of inevitability, the idea that democracy is inevitable. You also talk about the politics of eternity, and you contrast it to that. Tell us what that means.
So with the politics of inevitability and the politics of eternity, I'm really just trying to get across the idea that history is real and history matters, that history is out there for us to learn from, but we have to acknowledge it, and we have to be a little humble, and we have to learn. I think history is extremely empowering if we let it be, and the purpose of the book is to crystallize some lessons from difficult periods of history into a form that most Americans could follow most of the time. But history can only be useful to us if we're open to history. The politics of inevitability and the politics of eternity are kind of historical masquerades. They're ways that we claim to be paying attention to the past, but they're actually ways of being unhistorical. So with the politics of inevitability, what I have in mind is the idea, which is very widespread in this country, unfortunately, that history somehow ended in 1989 when communism came to an end, you know, that human nature means capitalism, capitalism means democracy, therefore, whatever the facts seem to be, however many exceptions keep racking up, that therefore we can just count on things moving in a certain direction. Everything's going to be fine. And that also means we don't have to really remember the concepts or the details about the past, because all that stuff in the past is just there to move us towards this inevitable story about the future. The great irony about that is that the reason that we think history came to an end is because communism came to an end, but communism came to an end because its story about the future is wrong. Our story about the future is wrong, too. All stories about the future are wrong, and they disarm you. They make you vulnerable. And then when a shock comes, you don't really know what to say because you've already said, I know what the future holds, but what if you're wrong? And you've already said, well, we don't really need to know about the past, but when shocks come, you really, really do need to know about the past. So one of these shocks was the election of November of 2016. And I could see and feel, and this is why I wrote about it, how people were slipping from that notion of inevitability to something else, which I call the politics of eternity. What the politics of eternity is the idea that things just keep happening, that history is a kind of cycle. And this is a very dangerous idea because it means you go from being sure that the future is going to be good to being sure that the future is going to be bad, that the same bad things just come around again and again, that the nation is virtuous, but it's vulnerable to outside attacks, and therefore you just have to be ready for outside attacks. So this is very much the politics of Mr. Trump, Mr. Bannon, the Make America Great Again, you know, where the again is really about the 1930s, and trying to get back to a sense of the rest of the world as a threat, of refugees as a threat, migrants as a threat, world economics as a threat, everything as a threat. Whether or not our leaders actually believe in this, what it does is it creates a kind of politics where everything is of the moment. So if we are constantly under all kinds of threat, then how can we possibly imagine that we could have reforms that might make things better? All you can do is panic constantly, and then, you know, your panic will prevent you from noticing that perhaps your health care was just taken away or your Medicaid was just taken away. And how can you complain about those things when there's a constant state of emergency, when the evildoers, the bad hombres, are always on the doorstep? So when I wrote the book, I was concerned about us shifting from one style of thinking about the future and past, which is wrong, to another style of thinking about future and past, which is also wrong and more dangerous. And what I was trying to do is to insert history between them, to say, look, we're at a historical moment of great significance. If we pause and think for a second and realize what the bad possibilities are, but also what the good actions are, what the historical limits are, but also what the historical possibilities are. If we see this moment and therefore see our own responsibility in this moment and for this moment, there's an awful lot that we can actually do if we choose to. So we have to shake out of the inevitability, shake out of the eternity, and take responsibility. And the book is basically a manual of that. It's a set of examples of people who did take responsibility, and it shows what they have learned and what they can teach us.
And it's a terrific book. I highly recommend it to all our listeners. I have ordered multiple copies to give away, and I recommend that listeners read it and do the same. Timothy Snyder, thank you so much for writing this book and talking with us about it.
It's been my great pleasure. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale University. Read his post summarizing his 20 lessons from the 20th century by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, was the machinery of authoritarianism already in place before Trump's election? We talk with Ryan Alford about his book, Permanent State of Emergency, after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In our first segment, historian Timothy Snyder talked about the threat of authoritarian rule in America if we the people don't stop it. But why are we so vulnerable to that threat in the first place? Our next guest, lawyer and constitutional scholar Ryan Alford, shows in his book Permanent State of Emergency that it didn't start with November's election. It started after 9/11, when the U.S. launched initiatives that eroded both constitutional and international law, like the indefinite detention and torture of detainees at Guantanamo, targeted killing with the drone program, and mass surveillance. Alford argues these policies legitimized an expansion of executive authority that negates the rule of law and undermines our government's checks and balances. Ryan Alford teaches law at Lakehead University in Canada. His research focuses on the rule of law and legal rights during public emergencies. Alford says he was compelled to write Permanent State of Emergency by two court cases he was consulted on. Both involved the Islamic cleric and American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed by an American drone on the orders of Barack Obama.
The first case was an action brought by a U.S. citizen who learned that he was on what's called the killer capture list, which in practice is actually a kill list because no one's actually captured by drone strikes. And he sought a declaration from the federal court in Washington that this would be unconstitutional. And I was asked to consult on that case by the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights. And the conclusion of the case was absolutely shocking. The federal justice who adjudicated it said, "I have no power to question the president's decisions in national security." So he applied a case called El Shifa when President Clinton bombed a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. And the court in that instance had said, well, this is a national security decision. The line of the opinion in the al-Awlaki litigation said, the mere fact that the target is a United States citizen does not change the fact that this is a non-justiciable political question reserved to the President of the United States. And when I saw that opinion, I thought, something has gone badly wrong with the constitutional law of the United States.
So this is the al-Awlaki. Now, this is not the same case as when the U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki was.
Yes, that's him.
That is him. Okay.
So prior to being killed, he actually did, or rather his father serving as his next friend, sought an action in a United States court to prevent it from happening. And then the second case that you mentioned was his father bringing an action for his wrongful death. And that case was similarly adjudicated. The court simply said, well, this is not the sort of thing that a United States court can decide in this moment in time. So it's rather momentous. The idea is that someone has a constitutional right not to be killed under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, and the court simply says, because the president has decided that he needs to do this, I'm not going to second-guess that decision.
And wasn't his son also killed by a drone strike?
Yes, although in that instance, the claim by the executive branch is that he was collateral damage and not specifically targeted. And additionally, in January of this year, his 8-year-old daughter, Nawar al-Awlaki, was killed in a United States Special Forces raid in Yemen.
Oh, wow. So here you have American citizens who are killed by drone strikes that have been ordered by the President of the United States. This seems to undo a law that's not only in the Constitution, but way older than that. Isn't the writ of habeas corpus something that is operational here, and that goes back to the Magna Carta in 1066?
Well, yes, if you look at Magna Carta and the version of Magna Carta that governs in the Commonwealth is the 1297 version of Magna Carta. It was passed in direct response to this kind of action. So the King of England decided that he could declare his personal enemies outlaws. So saying that they are, you know, they're treasonous, they're rebelling against the state, they can be killed on my order. That was problematic in the 13th century. So after that happened, after Magna Carta was ratified as a statute in England, there has never been a situation in the United Kingdom where a king of England, and this includes Henry VIII, attempted to have someone killed on his personal authority. So the problem was that when the United States Constitution was written in 1787, they didn't think to mention specifically that this couldn't be done. It having been embedded in the law of the United Kingdom for over 500 years, it's really amazing that at this point in time, the president reassumes a power that the King of England didn't have post-Magna Carta. So we have to go back to before Magna Carta to find someone, a king, with the sort of powers that the president of the United States claims to have in the 21st century.
You describe the U.S. as an elective dictatorship. What do you mean by that?
So essentially, the whole project of constitutionalism is to make sure that every political actor is accountable to the law. So there have been many crises in American democracy, so Watergate, for instance. President Nixon said, if the president does it, that means it's not illegal. And we said, absolutely not. What the president does has to be legal. He's held up to constitutional standards. And if he isn't, the United States Supreme Court will say that he needs to comply, as they did in United States versus Nixon, ordering him to turn over the Watergate tapes. And then he will be subjected to a process of impeachment, as he was before he resigned to prevent himself from being impeached. But at this moment in time, there is no legal accountability whatsoever for what the president does, as long as he invokes national security. So for me, what got me onto this path was that case when an American citizen was killed in a drone strike. And the court simply said, well, no, we can't hold the president accountable against constitutional standards. Well, if someone's no longer legally accountable, you don't have the rule of law. What you have is someone who's effectively a dictator, somebody who you say, well, solve all the problems, do what needs to be done, and we won't ask any questions. We will not subject you to any oversight or to any legal accountability. And that's currently what President Trump has inherited in the last election.
You also say that we have a real threat of what you call turnkey totalitarianism, because there are no firewalls standing in the way of any president who would create an authoritarian state. Now, this was something I've been concerned about since 2001, since 9/11, but even more concerned about when Barack Obama, who was a constitutional scholar and someone who I thought would redress the abrogation of the Constitution that happened under Bush, he didn't address it. He went even further. So you say this has been a bipartisan process. I wonder if you could elaborate how that's occurred.
Well, I think you have the essence of it entirely correct. When Barack Obama was elected president, he said, well, we need to look forward and not backwards. And so no one who was involved in torture or the setup of the Guantanamo Bay detention camp, contrary to international law, the people who prevented those prisoners from asserting habeas corpus, none of them were punished. And none of the programs were really rolled back. Maybe the most egregious programs at their edges were trimmed. But the problem was, he never said, the president of the United States does not have the authority to do these things. To some degree, he just toned them down. And some, in fact, he ramped up. The drone strike program, in fact, was expanded 500% during the Obama administration. But people who were impressed by the Obama administration said, well, he's not using these powers as aggressively. But if you look at what his lawyers were saying consistently in court from 2008 to 2016, they were consistently asserting that the president does have that authority to act unilaterally without being checked by any of the branches of government. And it was invoked sporadically in very problematic ways. The most problematic precedent, I would argue, was the bombing of Libya, where regime change was accomplished without any congressional input, contrary to the War Powers Resolution of 1974. So, in essence, we had kind of a kinder, gentler Bush administration with all of these powers in place, And then, well, when someone assumed the presidency, who is not really nearly as tactful or as likely to be concerned with what constitutional lawyers say, there's really no reason why he can't ramp these things up. And were there another terrorist attack on the United States at the scale of the 9/11 attacks, or another foreign war, so for instance, if the state of war which exists with Syria, limited as it is, becomes an unlimited war, well, we're going to see something much more dramatic than what occurred during the Bush administration.
Ryan Alford says that the key driver of authoritarian rule in the U.S. is the permanent state of emergency justified by war. And the key driver of perpetual war is the military-industrial complex, no matter who is president. For example, Trump ran on the promise of not getting involved in more wars and was accused of isolationism as a result. But now that he's in office, he's turning out to be as much a warmonger, if not more so, than his predecessors. I asked Ryan Alford to comment on that.
It's interesting to see this evolution in Trump, where he was saying repeatedly on the campaign trail that it would be a mistake for the United States to become ensnared in the Syrian war. But somehow he just seems to be descending into this tar pit very slowly, but in a sort of concerted fashion. We're sleepwalking our way into these situations. But there are, in fact, incredibly invested political actors, Congress being one of them, in the use of American force overseas. And Trump is learning about the various carrots and sticks that exist for any president. I mean, something that I love talking about in the book was the Carter administration. It's interesting to compare the Carter administration and the Ronald Reagan administration. So when Reagan did incredibly aggressive things unilaterally in foreign affairs, Congress could be counted upon to support him, and they said the president is the president. And so, looking forward in time, we thought, well, that's the way it's always been. Whenever the president is doing something that might be considered hostile or aggressive, Congress just follows him because it's the loyalty that the president requires. Now, if you look back at Carter, the opposite was true, because he was moving in the direction of peace. When he tried to create détente with the Soviet Union, when he entered into test ban treaties and missile limitation treaties, SALT I as it was then called, and then demilitarized the Panama Canal, this was action that turned Congress against him. Even members of his own party in Congress were essentially calling him a traitor, calling him soft on Russia, and this is sort of something that's quite remarkable, that the same people who say you have to be with the president right or wrong when he's agitating for war are the very same people who say, oh, the president's completely out of line, he's possibly even a traitor when he's talking about peace. And I think that Trump has witnessed to some degree the same dynamic coming from Congress. But unlike President Carter, I don't think he's really a person of principle. I think he responds to these incentives, and that's a really frightening thought. Because what he's learned is that, well, everyone will fall into line behind him when he behaves in a hostile fashion. And when he says things that seem patently sensible about, peace and international relations and staying out of foreign wars, he's derided. So this gives you a sense of how Congress, I believe, has been compromised. They will not play that role of checking the president's authority when he's acting in favor of aggressive action, taking warlike action outside of the United States, because it would simply endanger their reelection.
Yeah, and this also goes to the heart of what's happened to the checks and balances that are so fundamental to the operation of our democratic system or the way it was set up to be a democracy. You point out that Congress has given up without a fight its own power to, well, basically to adjudicate war, but also to pass legislation or have any check on the executive. What about the judiciary?
This is the real problem with prospects for reinstallation of the rule of law in the United States. So there's been a depoliticization of all these issues where Congress just says, well, let's invest all these powers in the president, and then you fight over who gets to be the president. So it's sort of a spoiled system for controlling everything through the executive branch. And then the only remaining possible check is the judiciary. So what they learned since Watergate, and this is the lessons of Watergate, essentially, for the president, very much reinforced by Bush versus Gore, is that if you do not control the judiciary, you do not have that complete freedom of action that you'd like. So Bush versus Gore, fascinating. When you read that decision and you get to the end and it says, this decision is confined to its facts. which is legalese for it's not going to be a precedent for the next time. So if the next time this happens, we might very well rule differently, right, in a case which split almost perfectly along partisan lines. Both parties learned this lesson that, well, what you really want to be powerful when you control the executive branch is to have total control of the judiciary. And so what we've seen is the stacking of the Supreme Court and the D.C. Circuit, which is the second most powerful court in the United States, with what I call executive branch loyalists. So if we don't know what that looks like, just go and look at the bio of Neil Gorsuch. So somebody who worked in incredibly sensitive positions inside the executive branch. And the very same for Samuel Alito, et cetera, et cetera. And I also should mention Elena Kagan. It's very much bipartisan. And those people make their bones by asserting this extreme view of the president's role in America's constitutional order, which is that when the president needs to do it, when he feels like he needs to act in order to save the Constitution, there are no constitutional restraints on his authority. So if you go back and you take a look at the memoranda that these people write when they're working inside the executive branch, they're constantly reasserting that theory. And Neil Gorsuch did it to say that there was no habeas corpus or prisoners at Guantanamo, that the executive branch officials couldn't be prosecuted for torture, very extreme positions. And then these people are the pool from which the president chooses the most important judges, the ones that are, in theory, responsible for checking the executive branch. Well, you're not going to get very effective checking of the executive branch when the people who are on that bench are essentially executive branch lawyers wearing judges' robes.
Well, this is so interesting because during the Obama administration, he wasn't even able to get to appoint many federal judges. Much less, he wasn't able to appoint Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. And many people say, well, Obama couldn't get anything done because Congress didn't let him. And also, finally, we can see how Trump, you know, Obama had to resort to executive orders in order to get anything done because the Congress impeded all of his, usually his positive legislative pushes. So I wonder if you could comment on this president who was kind of cut off at the knees, ending up in empowering a more dictatorial presidency.
It's a fascinating dynamic. So you have to ask yourself, why are we so concerned with who's on the Supreme Court of the United States? It was deep. It's not a very political position until about 30 or 40 years ago. Just the people, you know, people appointed members of the opposite party all the time, and you couldn't predict from the party affiliation of the justice how they were going to rule. So, for instance, I know somebody who clerked for someone who was appointed by Lyndon Johnson, Justice Stevens, who ended up being, you know, quite predictably liberal, despite the fact that he was thought to be a conservative when he was appointed. And the same for many other justices who ended up being great disappointments, you know, for the presidents who appointed them. Why now are we so concerned with this? Why are we all speculating about, well, who's going to replace Anthony Kennedy? It's because everything's changed, because essentially now, this is now a critical nexus for the executive branch. When they're pushing their powers further than they ever have before, so the only possible check on their authority is the Constitution itself, rather than the political process. They then have to take out that last remaining roadblock. And I think the Republicans understood that by forcing the president to do everything through executive order, by doing it in a way that bypassed every other political actor, that they were helping to enable a system that was inevitably going to accrue to their own advantage. That it really is easier to get things done when you do it by executive order. And if that becomes legitimate to every political party, if no one stands on process, if no one stands on the legalities of things, but rather just says, well, this is how things are going to get done, then it's just two parties with very similar principles squabbling over who gets to be the decider. And they like that. They like that very much. They think that, you know, I think the people who fund the Republican Party, who for the most part now also fund the Democratic Party, they find this to be functional because it's just so much easier to lobby the executive branch than it is to lobby each member of Congress, even though it is pretty much down to a science for these groups right now. It's just simpler for them to say, well, we control this one political actor, and when we have bought this person, they're going to stay bought. And so one of the most interesting documents released during the Obama presidency was some emails between people in his campaign about who would be appointed to the cabinet. So essentially people there at the highest echelons of the banking community, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, had an incredible amount of input into who would be in the cabinet chosen by the President of the United States. And so if they see a regulatory project and they want to get it done, it's just easier to say that, well, we'll just make it the political system such that everything's dysfunctional. The only way that things can get done is if the president acts, and that people then lionize the president for doing so. They say, well, good for the president for cutting through all this legislative mumbo-jumbo, rather than saying, well, is this what we really want? That, you know, we just fight over who gets to be the elected dictator, and then he does whatever he wants? But it seems to me that both Democrats and Republicans are entirely okay with the president has these unbounded powers, just as long as that president is someone with whom they agree.
So is there anything that we can do to bring back our democracy and the rule of law in our country?
I think we can, and I think there is a very interesting lesson to be learned from history. I think that when we focus on Nixon's impeachment, we talk about Woodward and Bernstein, we talk about the hearings that were held and the tapes from President Nixon's office being ordered to be produced to that committee by the Supreme Court of the United States. What we forget is that several months earlier, there had been a march on the Pentagon of over 1 million people. There had been protests across the United States, ROTC stations being closed down on American campuses. It was clear that the young people of the United States were simply not going to tolerate the continuation of a war that had dragged on interminably. And as Mario Savio said in Berkeley, sometimes you have to put your body on the gears to prevent the machinery of continual warfare from moving. And those people were doing that. Watergate didn't occur in a vacuum. President Nixon was under siege because of his decision to ramp up aggressive war that America no longer had any appetite for. And only then did the other organs of government that are designed to work as checks and balances start to turn against him. So the people who are protesting against President Trump, people say, well, what good is a protest? Everything's going to happen in the corridors of power. I disagree. I think that the continuous pressure being put by these protests on the executive branch is absolutely critical, and I think it needs to be increased to the same level that it existed in from 1971 to 1973. And we're nowhere near that. We need to ramp this up by an order of magnitude to get to that position. But I think that that is the blueprint. I think that it's going to be in the streets and not in the courts or in Congress.
And I remember those days when I was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, when we had demonstrations of 10,000 people that happened two or three times a day. You're right. There was a ferment, and we, you know, the students came under, were not popular, but we did shift the national conversation and set up those conditions that you talk about. Well, Ryan Alford, I want to thank you so much. This is a terrific book. It's a very compelling read. It's absolutely terrifying. Permanent State of Emergency, The Demise of the Rule of Law in the United States. Thanks for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Ryan Alford teaches law at Lakefield University in Canada. You can read his 2011 essay on targeted killing, Sentence First, Verdict Afterwards, by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.